Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here for the next hour talking to you about our environment, our health, and some good food. I have a wonderful guest for you today. My guest today will be Clark Barlow. He is the owner of a restaurant called Heirloom Restaurant in North Carolina. And I'm going to tell you more about him and invite him on in just a little bit. But first, I wanted to talk to you about some things in the news. And, of course, the biggest news is our president-elect, Trump. I know many of you out there, if you're like me, are shocked by this new elected president. And yet it's a wake-up call to, you know, so many people in our country that are disenfranchised and frustrated and angry and just are reaching out for change. And it's interesting because I also am frustrated and disgusted with politics and wanting change. And, you know, for me, you know, choosing Trump was not the change I wanted, but I do want change. You know, I was looking forward to Bernie way back during, before the primaries, but this is what we have. And so now we're left to contemplate this and to figure out how we can work together to bring us together, basically. How can we work together so that all the nonprofit grassroots organizations that are so close to my heart, how can they come together and create a powerful voice and include the people that are, that chose to vote for Trump, figure out a way to, you know, find a mutual common ground that they can relate to. And, you know, I've said this so many times, and one of those ways I think is food. We all eat and we all care about our food. And, granted, you know, many people who are really hurting financially feel they can't afford healthy food, and that's one of the things we need to fight for and work for. Food access and access to healthy food is a right that everybody should be able to take part of, and it shouldn't be just for the elitist. It shouldn't be for just the people that have money. Everyone needs to eat fruits and vegetables. You know, the research is coming in loud and clear, and that's what we need to do. But to deal with everybody's shock of this election, I would love to share a story with you that someone shared with me that just is a reminder that sometimes we don't really know why certain things happen. But if we step back and just trust that sometimes things happen for a reason that we just don't understand. And so this is a little Zen Buddhist story that someone reminded me of, and I just think it, you know, speaks so much to today. So this is a story of an old farmer who had worked his crops for many years. One day, his horse ran away. Upon hearing the news, his neighbors came to visit. "Such bad luck," they said sympathetically. "Maybe," the farmer replied. The next morning, the horse returned, bringing with it three other wild horses. "How wonderful," the neighbors exclaimed. "Maybe," replied the old man. The following day, his son tried to ride one of the untamed horses, was thrown from the horse and broke his leg. The neighbors again came to offer their sympathy on his misfortune. "Maybe," said the farmer. The day after, the military officials came to the village to draft young men into the army. Seeing that the son's leg was broken, they passed him by. The neighbors congratulated the farmer on how well things had turned out. And well, the farmer replied, "Maybe." And so the point of this parable is that sometimes we just don't understand from where we're sitting what the reason is why something happens. And in this time of shock for so many, we need to just step back and just trust and keep doing our work and try to bring people together, try to meet everybody where they are, and through love and compassion and honesty, try to bring them on board and try to create bridges, walls. So that being said, I want to just now move on, but I wanted to share that with you because it really spoke to me the other night when I was watching the results, and just been so shocked. So anyway, there's some great events going on in around the city that I want to share with you. Tonight at FIT, at the Katie Murphy Amphitheater, there is a Feel to Frock event called Fashion Lessons from the Slow Food Movement. And this should be a great event. It has a panel moderator of Summer Rain Oaks. She's the director of marketing for Food Stand, and also a vegan chef, Daphne Chang, and a fashion designer, Jusara Lee, along with Richard McCarthy, the executive director of Slow Food USA. And they're going to be exploring how the fashion industry and the good food movement can really kind of merge together. So this should be it's a free event, but it is first come, first serve. So get there early. It's from 6 to 8 this evening. Also tonight, the Sierra Club in Long Island is screening the documentary Dirt, the movie, at the Copaig Memorial Public Library. That should be a great film to see, and a discussion following that. Also, another event is the Slow Food East End is having a market dinner, but not out on the East End. They're actually doing this one in the city at Jimmy's 43. So that more people can participate. It's celebrating the Long Island Cheese Pumpkin, which is a variety of pumpkin grown on Long Island that is, you know, was in threat of disappearing. And we all know that Slow Food works so tirelessly to try to preserve biodiversity in our food supply. And this is one of those varieties that we're really trying to bring back. So this Long Island Cheese Pumpkin event has many parts to it. There's the dinner taking place at Jimmy's 43 on Monday evening, but there's other events working up to it. So you can find out about all these events on my website at iegreen.com. Also, November 14th, Hunter College has their food policy breakfast series, and this one is on food and health technology. And discussing the intersection of these two areas of food and technology and how they can improve the health for people and better understanding. So that should be a really interesting discussion. You know, this breakfast series that the food policy of New York does up at Hunter College is really great. They're free, and it's a great way to start your morning. They put out a healthy breakfast. I definitely recommend checking that out. This weekend, November 12th, the Change Food Fest is happening. Change Food Fest used to be known as TEDx Manhattan, but they had to change their name. And so now it's the Change Food Fest, but there's a whole day of scheduling of different speakers. It should be really great. Tickets were $420, and I guess they have not sold them out. So if you use the code that's on my website, tickets will be discounted to $150. However, if that's still too much for you, there are lots of live screenings taking place around the country to see this. And I know my Slow Food chapter, Slow Food North Shore, is co-hosting a live screening out at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. That will be all day on Saturday from 10:30 to 6. There will be some refreshments, and it's a nice time to come down and meet other Slow Food people and people who care about our food system. November 15th, there is also a documentary presentation at the Cinema Arts Center that is being sponsored by Plant Pure Communities. And this is a screening of a film called Pills, Procedures, or Plants. And Dr. Colin Campbell will be the guest speaker. He is the man behind the China Study, a wonderful doctor and a big speaker for plant-based foods and the benefits of eating a plant-based diet. So that should be interesting. That's November 15th from 6 to 10 for $25. The Sierra Club is hosting, the New York City Sierra Club is hosting an event in the city, and they will be screening a film called New York City Inspiring Connections Outdoors. And so that should be great. I am putting out some food for that. So I hope you can come and see that. So anyway, like I said, all these events are posted on my website. But the biggest event that I'm gearing up for is my Thanksgiving Feast for the Homeless. As many of you know, I've been doing this for 22 years. This is my 22nd year working with the River Fund Food Pantry. And we cook for about 600 people who come to the park, as well as we make enough food for another 400 people or so for them to deliver to a battered women's shelter and to a men's shelter. And what we do is gather at the Long Island IE Green Homestead, and there people cook. And there's a sign-up schedule on my website where you can sign up for a different shift. I have over 100 people that pass through my kitchen over the weekend, cooking, prepping, scrubbing, whatever needs to be done to create this feast. So it's really a fun community event, and it's a great opportunity to model for your kids, giving back to the community, and it's just a wonderful event. So if you want to participate, you can find out more information about that also on my website. I want to share a recipe with you now before I invite my guest, Clark Barlow, on. So this recipe is a vegan gluten-free tamale recipe. It's a three bean portobello mushroom tamales. And sometimes I just get cravings for something. And, you know, tamales is one of those foods that's very hard to find out and find it vegan. So I have to make my own. So this is a great recipe. It, you know, does take a little bit of time. It's not your weekday dinner that you're just going to throw together in 20 minutes. But it's really a wonderful recipe that you actually can make ahead of time, and, you know, for company, and have it ready and just steam it up when everybody comes. So it's a great recipe for that. So this recipe makes about 25 tamales, and you'll end up with an extra quart of the filling, or you can actually double the tamale dough recipe and make 50 tamales. Okay, so for the dough, you're going to start with 2.5 cups of masa harina. That's corn, kind of cornmeal with some lime in it. It's delicious. 1.5 cups of hot water, 1 cup of cold coconut oil, 2 teaspoons baking powder, 1.5 teaspoons sea salt, and 1/2 cup of vegetable broth. And in a large bowl, you're going to stir the masa harina with the hot water until it's all moistened. Let it cool, and in the bowl of a standing electric mixer using a paddle blade, mix the coconut oil with the baking powder and the salt at medium speed until fluffy, about 3 minutes. With the machine on, add the corn masa mix in golf ball-sized lumps, and then drizzle in the vegetable stock and beat the masa until completely smooth. Increase the speed to high and beat it up till it's fluffy, about 3 minutes. And the texture should resemble something like mashed potatoes. You can cover the bowl with a damp cloth and set it aside until you're ready to fill the tamales. And for the chili filling, you need some olive oil for stir-fry, for the sauteing, 2 large onions, or 4 smaller ones, 1 chopped yellow bell pepper, 1 chopped red bell pepper, 1 chopped jalapeno pepper, 1 chopped serrano pepper, 3 portobello mushrooms, 2 cups of fire-roasted corn, and I buy frozen organic fire roasted corn at Whole Foods. You know, if it's in season for corn, of course you're welcome to do that on your own, but you can buy the frozen pack and it really works just fine in this recipe. 1 can of fire roasted tomatoes. I use the ones that I get at Trader Joe's. It already has some chili in it, so it's already a little spicy. 2 teaspoons of chili powder, 1 teaspoon salt, 2 teaspoons cumin, 1/2 teaspoon of red pepper flakes, 1 teaspoon of smoked paprika, 1 teaspoon cumin, 1 teaspoon chili powder, 1 teaspoon smoked paprika, 1 can organic pinto. Hold on, I just said the smoked paprika twice. Sorry about that. 1 can organic kidney beans, 1 can of black beans, and 1/2 cup of chopped cilantro. Now, some people really don't like cilantro. We've discussed this before. If you're one of those people, you can easily leave it out. You can also substitute regular parsley for the cilantro. But using a heavy skillet, you're going to saute the onion in the olive oil until it's translucent. Then you're going to add the peppers and the garlic and continue cooking until those are soft. add the portobello mushrooms, all the spices and the corn, and cook for about 10 minutes until the flavors start coming together. Then you add the beans, the fire roasted tomatoes, and the cilantro. Cook for another few minutes, allow the flavors to meld, and then adjust the spices to your taste. And then, you know, at Todd's Pass, I've made a sauce with tomatillos, but I did not have any of those, so I used what I had in the house. I used one small green bell pepper, one small yellow bell pepper, a chopped jalapeno and a chopped serrano pepper, one chopped red onion, half a cup of cherry tomatoes. Still have cherry tomatoes out in my garden, believe it or not. Half a cup of cilantro, a quarter cup of cacao nibs. And I wanted cocoa, and that's what I had in the house. So I used the cacao nibs, and because they did not melt down, I actually then had to puree them towards the end of this recipe. Salt to taste, a can of fire-roasted tomatoes with chili, a tablespoon of garlic, and a third cup of white wine. And I sauteed the onions in the oil for a couple of minutes, then added the peppers and the garlic. Cooked those down for a while, added the cherry tomatoes and the serrano peppers. Then I added the can of fire-roasted tomatoes, the wine, and the cacao nibs. And I cooked that for a little bit, and then I placed all the ingredients into a blender and pureed that up. You can also use an immersion blender if you'd like, and adjust the seasonings to your taste. And that was it. And it was great, you know, a great mole-type sauce. And it was wonderful on the tamales. So to assemble the tamales, I didn't mention about the corn husks. Sorry about that. You're going to need a package of corn husks that you're going to soak in hot water for 40 minutes. And so then you're going to take the corn husks out of the water. They're now soft, and pat them dry. And I worked in batches of four, and I laid the husks out on a towel, and I spread about 2 tablespoons of the dough in an even layer across the wide end of the husk, creating a rectangle of the dough upwards, you know, vertical. And then I left about a half an inch border on the edges, and I spooned 1 tablespoon of the chili filling down the line, down the center of the dough. And then I rolled the husk so that the dough surrounded the chili filling, and then folded the bottom under. And I tied it up with some of the corn husks. I donated 2 horn husks to create twine, and I ripped the corn husks so I had, you know, little pieces of corn husk, and I tied the tamales with the strands of corn husks. And I continued that until all the tamales were filled. And then to cook them, you're going to stand them up in a steamer. You know, you need a lot of water because they have to steam for about 1.5 hours. So you need to fill the bottom of a pot with water, put in a steamer. If the steamer doesn't fill the pot fully, you can make little balls of aluminum foil to fill in the gaps around the edges so that the tamales don't fall through. And then stand all the tamales up in the pot. And you can also use balls of aluminum foil to help stand them up vertical. And you're going to steam them for about 1.5 hours until they're finished, and that is it. And then you serve them with the sauce on the side, and they're just great. So enjoy them. If you have any questions, the recipes, of course, are posted on my website and the Progressive Radio Network website. And I'm always available with questions at Bhavani@IDGreen. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's guest. Chef Clark Barlow is the founder of Heirloom Restaurant in North Carolina, and he is a graduate of the Johnson Wells School in Charlotte, North Carolina, and has worked in many, many restaurants, some of them French Laundry and Iboulli in Spain. He also appeared on the Food Network's Chopped, and he actually beat Bobby Flay. So it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Chef Clark Barlow. Chef, you with me?
Yes. Good morning, Bhavani. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well.
Good. Thank you so much for joining me this morning on my show. I'm really excited to have you on and learn about not just your restaurant and your upcoming book, but to also find out what is Appalachian food. I know that's kind of your specialty and what you serve at your restaurant. So maybe you can start by telling us what that is.
Yeah, of course. So Heirloom Restaurant is in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we opened in February of 2014 with a mission to serve only North Carolina ingredients. So we develop the menu every day based on what's coming in from the farms. We try and be as look through the lens of exactly what's coming through the kitchen, through the farms, and then write the menu based on that. So the menu changes every day. The wine is sourced from North Carolina wineries. The beer is from North Carolina breweries. The liquor is all from North Carolina distilleries. When I say everything comes from North Carolina, I try to take it to the very last detail, the soap in the bathrooms, the salt on the table. It's truly a reflection of what North Carolina is.
Wow. Wow. I guess you can do that because they actually grow things year-round there.
Yeah, we're very fortunate in that.
That's great. And your family comes from that area, right? You have like seven generations based in the area?
Yes, I'm from Caldwell County. It's about an hour and a half west of Charlotte, and my family has been in North Carolina. I'm the seventh generation of my family in North Carolina, so I have very strong ties to the state.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the traditional foods from North Carolina and Appalachian cuisine that you talk about?
Most people, when they think about Southern cuisine, especially North Carolina, immediately the mind goes to barbecue, a lot of fried foods, very much the stereotypical Southern cuisine. The cuisine that I see emerging now, this Appalachian cuisine, is very much focused ingredient-driven cuisine. It's the ingredients that I grew up with, the ingredients that are native or being grown here in North Carolina, and just the resourcefulness and everything that goes around this sort of old food way.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of those ingredients that are not, you know, possibly as familiar with people in other parts of the country?
I think field peas are a very big one. I think most people are familiar with black-eyed peas, but there's so many different varieties of field peas. Those are definitely one. I think a lot of cooked greens that we work with here. I've got a soup on the menu this morning that's focused on field peas and turnip greens, which I think is very much a Southern Appalachian style soup. And then we've got everything from branch lettuce to fiddlehead ferns, wild foraged mushrooms. There's a whole cornucopia of ingredients that are very iconically Appalachian.
Mm-hmm. And is the menu predominantly like meat heavy, or do you also have a lot of, because I know, you know, in Southern cooking, when I think of the greens, you know, you always have to, if you're a vegetarian, you always have to ask whether they have, you know, any lard in them or anything like that.
Traditionally, I think that was the case, where there would be a ham bone or a ham hock cooked in with the greens and the legumes. I like to think that the food that we do at Heirloom is very much vegetable-focused, because we have so many great vegetable farmers in North Carolina. And so this ability to focus just strictly on the vegetables, and really the reason for that ham hock and the process of adding pork to the greens was just to add more flavor to the greens. Now I find that we're working with such high-quality ingredients that you really don't need to add any more flavor, that the flavor of the greens and the other vegetables really speak for themselves.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, you know, because also, you know, fried food is, you know, also, as you said, a traditional food down there. And I know there's also, you know, that's in conflict with people trying to improve their health through diet. How do you address that?
I mean, I'm certainly a big fan of fried food. We do fried chicken here at the restaurant. We do country fried steak. But I think there's a balance with anything. Like I said, we do have some fried dishes on the menu, but then we also have dishes that are oven roasted and pan roasted and steamed. I just look at frying as any other cooking process. A menu needs to have balance, and dishes need to have balance. So if it's in moderation, I think it's perfectly acceptable. And I think it's sort of emblematic of our food to have some fried dishes on the menu, but then some dishes that also focus on other cooking techniques.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. I am a firm believer also in balance. And I, you know, fried foods are delicious. I mean, nobody can deny that. So it's really nice to have them as, you know, I think of them, you know, as Cookie Monster does a sometime food, not an everyday
exactly.
food. And they're great. And so eating out is, you know, a great time to indulge in the fried food. So, yeah, I would think you would have to have some balance there. So I know you have an upcoming cookbook. Will this be your first? And can you tell us a little bit about it?
It will be my first. And, I mean, we're still very much in the developmental stages of it now, and I'm working on it right now. It's been so hectic right now. We're revamping the menu at the restaurant. We're going through the holidays right now, and I've added this cookbook onto my plate. So I'm more than happy to talk more about it as it develops later on. But right now, we're still very much in the developmental stages. We are going to focus on Appalachian cuisine, the cuisine that we are working on creating here at the restaurant. But beyond that, it's really still developing right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. I know it takes, you know, I see some chefs coming out with book after book after book, and I'm like, they must have help, because I have a book that I've been working on for years, and I just can't find the time. It's just,
I'm so impressed with writers. Every time I sit down to work on the book, I'm just more and more enamored with the writers that I admire, because it's a completely different skill set than being a chef. And even recipe writing for the book as opposed to recipe writing for the restaurant is something completely different. When I write recipes for my cooks, there's an understanding that goes along with the recipes. There's these unspoken things that, because of the years that we've worked together, they understand. When you're writing recipes for books and writing recipes for the general public, you really want to make sure that every last detail is put into the recipe, because you want to make sure that the recipes are tested properly and make sure that the cooks that are cooking out of your book, whether it's at home or in a professional kitchen, can replicate the recipe the exact same way you did in your kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. Now, I know you, you are enamored with foraging for your own vegetables for the restaurant. Can you tell us about what you actually forage for, but then also how are you going to work that into your recipes in the book? It's going to be stuff that people can actually find in the store, or you could tell people where to go find it in the woods.
Well, exactly. I mean, the foraging is a huge part about what we do here at the restaurant, because I think for us to have this true connection to where we are and the food that we're cooking, wild ingredients sort of go hand in hand with that. So we foraged a lot of different things over the years here at the restaurant. We foraged a lot of wild mushrooms, and we finally got that legislation changed here in North Carolina so that we're going to be able to do that starting in January and do that legally. So that's a nice change of pace.
Good.
But we've also foraged, there's a number of wild greens you can forage in North Carolina. It's nut season right now, so we're picking as many acorns as we possibly can, and hickory nuts and black walnuts. And then leaves have been something that I've gotten really into in the last year and a half, working with oak leaves and maple leaves and just a different varieties of each of those, and trying to cook those in stocks and make broths out of them and fry the leaves and wrap
Wait,
them.
I have to stop you. I have not heard about that. All the other ones, yes, but oak leaves and maple leaves? Tell me, what do you do with oak leaves and maple leaves? I didn't know they're edible.
Yeah, oak leaves are very, very interesting. And, I mean, obviously, if people have allergies, and that's the most difficult thing that we have to be careful with when we're working with these ingredients, that some people have oak allergies. And so you want to make sure that anybody that you're cooking these for has their dietary restrictions, they're knowledgeable about them. And then even if just eating a small portion of something and then continuing onward, I think that's the best way to go with any new ingredient that you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
But so oak leaves, whenever we're working with those, I try and get them right off the tree at this time of year when they started to dry on the tree. And then we'll take them and we'll cook them into a broth, just cover them in water and cook them for an hour or two. The longer it cooks, the more flavor you're going to get out of it, but you're also going to get more tannins. I think most of us associate tannins with red wine, but the tannins in red wine are coming from it being aged in the barrels, as well as from some other factors as well. But you're getting those tannins, so you're getting that bitter flavor. But if you cook an oak leaf broth for about an hour and 20 minutes on a slow simmer and then strain that off, it has very much the flavor of Southern iced tea. It's a very white broth, just some really neat vegetal and sort of fall notes to it. So it has really,
and so when you make a pot of that, are you filling the pot with lots of oak leaves and just covering it with water, or are you having a lot of water to the ratio of oak leaves?
I'd say it's the we'll fill the pot up about three quarters of the way and then cover the pot with water. It's a pretty good amount of leaves in the broth, because the more leaves you have, obviously, the more flavor you're going to get. But then that broth has so many uses once it comes off. We use it as a soup base. We've actually added pectin to it and sugar and made a jelly out of it. So there's a lot of uses for it.
Wow. So it's like an umami, or like, you know, just using stock in recipes as opposed to just water to give that extra depth of flavor.
Exactly.
Oh, I love it. Thank you. I'm going to try that. Oak leaves I have plenty of.
Exactly, right? And so I think you had also asked how we're going to incorporate foraging into the book and if the ingredients will be accessible. And that's one of the things that I really haven't been having to keep in mind whenever we're working on this book, is we do want to have some interesting ingredients out there, but we also want to make this approachable for everybody. So the ingredients that we're going to be working with in the book, whether they're forage ingredients, if they're forage ingredients that aren't accessible to everyone, there will be substitutions offered. But there's going to be a large variety of ingredients throughout the book, both conventional and foraged.
Mm-hmm. And what about your sourcing of animals? I know you mentioned to me that you like to source whole animals. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we do that almost exclusively at the restaurant, because for us it's a sustainable thing. Whenever we're talking about working with any protein at the restaurant, we're trying to get it in whole animal form. I think it allows us to show the most respect for the product that we're working with, and it's also the most sustainable process. I always go to the point of beef, and whenever you think about most chain restaurants or most corporate restaurants, they always have a fillet on the menu. And to have an 8-ounce fillet on the menu, you're getting roughly 20 to 24, 26 possibly fillets out of a whole cow. And on a conservative estimate, a large corporate restaurant is going to sell 50, possibly 60 fillets a night. So we're talking 2 to 2.5 cows a night just to have a one steak on the menu. And you multiply that out by the number of restaurants in a city and the number of restaurants in the country, and you realize why we have these capos and these confined feeding operations everywhere on the world, because for this demand of beef, you have to have the supply. And so for us at the restaurant, we only work with whole animals, and working with whole cows allows us to just work through the entire cow. So on the complete opposite side of the example I just gave, we use 2, possibly 3 cows a year. So I think looking at that model, it's much easier to see how to produce a really sustainable meat supply.
Mm-hmm. But that would require you then to freeze a lot of it, right? Because you can't use it all that quickly.
Exactly. We're freezing a lot of it. We're doing different preparations on it. So whether it's salt preservation or whether we're grinding and making sausage or any different preparations on that. So, yes, it does require you to freeze a lot of it. And it also requires you to change the menu fairly frequently, because you're only getting 20 fillets and you're only getting 20 or so ribeyes and 20 or so New York strips. So it's just one of those things, you have to continually change the menu based on what you're working through at that moment in time.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, for myself, as a primarily a vegetarian chef, but, you know, I also run my local slow food chapter and am very much in tune with people who eat meat and, you know, and love it. And so one of the slow food campaigns is called Slow Meat, and it's really kind of about what you're talking about, that using meat, you know, it's not sustainable for people to sit down to a 12-ounce steak and eat that whole thing at one meal. It's just, it's also just too much meat for your body, not healthy, blah, 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 blah. So anyway, using the meat in a way so that you can use it for flavoring, you know, they talk about that a lot. So you can, you know, extend, you know, use less meat and still feel like you're eating it if you feel like you need to eat it, you know, without sitting down to a whole steak yourself. So,
oh yeah,
you know,
I mean, I absolutely
agree. I'm sure you're doing that too.
Yeah, Dan Barber did a fantastic job of sort of putting a voice behind that with his book, The Third Plate. I mean, I think he really hit the nail on the head with our consumption of meat and how we really need to rethink what's on our plate in terms of the ratio of meat to vegetable to starch and grain.
Let's take a couple-minute break, Clark, and when we come back, I actually want to talk a little bit about some of the nonprofit work that you do, you know, with the Green Teachers Network and some of the other projects that I read about that you're involved in that has me so interested because it's something I'm really passionate about. So anyway, everyone, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. I'm talking with Chef Clark Barlow from the Heirloom Restaurant, and I'm Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Be
PRN.FM, your station for progressive viewpoints on politics, economics, health, the environment, and a whole lot more. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Mike Fader. I want to tell you about my show, The Turning Point, broadcast every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. It's not just politics or pop culture or art or personal essays or storytelling. It's all of those. And it's in a spontaneous blend of stream of consciousness expression. It's not bad. Sex, children, work, beauty, ecstasy, death, regeneration. That's The Turning Point every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Now, you don't have to come with us, but what would the neighbors say?
Hi, I'm David Crow, host of The Infectious Myth that airs at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN. I use data to deconstruct the myths that infect the modern world. Myths within health and medicine, other areas of science, the justice system, society, media, censorship, and politics. Join me for challenging interviews and discussions. Listen live, as a podcast, or by dialing 701-719-0990. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm here with my guest today, Chef Clark Barlow from the Heirloom Restaurant in Charlotte, North Carolina. Chef, you with me?
Yes. How are you doing?
Good. So can you tell us about the Green Teachers Network that you helped help found?
No, I did not help found it. I was a board member of the Green Teachers Network.
Okay,
I helped found the Charlotte Community Health Coalition, another thing that I work with. But the Green Teachers Network is a nonprofit that works with local schools here in the Charlotte area to basically engage students and educate them on good food practices, whether it be farming or eating habits. So it's a really exciting thing for me to be involved in. I'm incredibly passionate about engaging and teaching the next generation about good food practices. So it's something very exciting for me.
Yeah, it's a passionate or a passion of mine as well. You know, I don't get to work with as many schools. I'm outside of New York, and I know in the city there's quite a bit of people, you know, Just Food and other organizations working to bring gardens to schools. And out on the East End, our slow food movement has a really great gardens and school program. And, you know, I'm working with a few school groups on Long Island, but it's really hard to get them to take it up. Where does your funding come from for that?
Well, Green Teachers Network has just merged in the last few months with Real School Food, which is a nonprofit based out of D.C. They've been working. Green Teachers Network had already developed curriculums based around the gardens and how to teach the students through the gardens. So I think that was something that was of value to Real School Food. And so with the merger now, I think there's going to be a lot more exciting things that Green Teachers Network is able to accomplish. So it's a real exciting time to be with Green Teachers Network.
Uh-huh. That's great. You know, because study after study shows that when you're working with the kids and you're getting them to grow the vegetables, they're so much more likely to want to eat them. And especially up here in inner city kids that don't get access to as much fresh fruits and vegetables as would be good for them. It's a wonderful program to really wake them up and get them more familiar with what they can grow, and it empowers them. It's just, it's amazing. So
we see that all the time, that whenever you actually work with a student to plant the seed and see the plant grow, and then whether you're harvesting a carrot or a tomato, you just see that sense of pride, and then they enjoy the vegetable so much more. So,
right. And so can you also tell us about the Mecklenburg Community Food Health Coalition that you did help found?
Exactly. So the Community Health Coalition is a partnership between individuals in the private sector as well as the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Health Department. We were having so many issues with health inspectors coming into restaurants or food trucks and enforcing the food code that we operate here in North Carolina. But the knowledge wasn't there, whether it be in the restaurateur, the operator base, or necessarily the education, the information wasn't there on the inspector's case. So we formed a partnership between myself, several other chefs and business owners here in the city, and then, like I said, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Health Department. So we sit down once a quarter and talk about the issues that the inspectors are facing and talk about the issues that the operators are facing, and we try and come to a mutual understanding, work through the issues rather than just having issues with inspectors getting in disputes with operators or chefs whenever they get onto the property. So I think it's definitely moving in a better direction. And I think because of that, we had some change with the wild mushroom legislation in North Carolina. So it really is exciting to see communities working with the municipalities and really getting real change accomplished.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're aware of the raw food and the raw milk issue. How does your health department handle that? Are you allowed to work with raw milk? Are they allowed to sell raw milk in North Carolina?
In North Carolina, we cannot sell raw milk. In South Carolina, you're allowed to sell raw milk. But in North Carolina, we still have a ban on raw milk. And looking at it from a public health perspective, I can understand where they're coming from. I might not necessarily agree with it, but I can understand what the issue is.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. I want to go back to your restaurant a little bit. You know, I know that you limit your menu to products only produced in North Carolina. Do you find that limiting? Can you really, I guess you're doing it, so obviously you can. But, you know, what about like different fruits? What kind of fruits are you able to get in North Carolina, and how does that impact your menu?
So I don't find it limiting. I almost find it very inspiring to be only working with North Carolina ingredients, because I've worked in so many restaurants over the years where you were just able to pick up the phone at 11 o'clock at night and call in a produce order, and then everything was sitting on your doorstep the next morning when you get in. With what we have now and the way we operate Heirloom, there's so many different ways that we communicate with so many different farmers, and whether it's a text or a phone call or meeting them at the market, it's inspiring to see all these different things and how it all comes together, and there's a lot more thought that goes into how we source our products now. But this time of year, like, we've got apples that are in season, we've got some gorgeous winter squash that's in season right now, persimmons are one of my favorite ingredients and fruits to work with this time of year. And we've also done a really good job this year specifically of preserving a lot of things throughout the year. So whenever blackberries were in season and whenever raspberries were in season, we were buying enough to put on the menu and then also enough to freeze for the upcoming months.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the most important thing to think about whenever a restaurant's trying to source locally. I hear so many farm-to-table restaurants saying, we're so fresh that we don't even have a freezer. And it's like, all right, well, that's going to be pretty difficult when you get into the winter months. Because
right.
as fun as it is to work with leafy greens and squash and sweet potatoes and root vegetables for 4 months, I like to have just a little bit of diversity in my food. So we've put up a lot of tomato sauce. We've frozen a lot of asparagus. We've frozen a lot of broccoli, frozen a lot of green beans. So it's just trying to put up as much of the food as you can during the spring, summer, fall months so that whenever winter comes, you're not completely out in the cold.
Right, right. And also, people ask me that all the time, whether, you know, you lose the nutritional value. And if you are freezing things at the height of their season, at the peak of their flavor, you really can capture that when you freeze it. And, you know, it's certainly better than, you know, importing something from Chile or Peru and getting it here when they picked it before it even had any flavor. So you're never getting it in a full flavor way. People don't realize that. I mean, I think, you know, our taste buds in this country, you know, I mean, people always go to Italy and say, oh my God, the food's so good over there, you know, and they don't realize it's the quality of the ingredients that they're getting, that they're starting with. And when you're making something with something that has no flavor to start with, it's very challenging to give it the flavor it's supposed to have.
I try to make that point all the time. And I try to make that point to my cooks as well as our guests that what we're doing to the food is actually very, very simple processes. Like whether it's just a little bit of canola oil on something and salt and pepper and garlic and letting it roast in the oven, if the ingredient is of super high quality, then that simple preparation can really elevate it.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. You know, and that's why sometimes my recipes, you know, I'm coming up with a recipe and I have to work with what I have in my kitchen. And so that's why the cacao nibs were interesting to put into that tamale sauce, because I never did that before. But, you know, I didn't have the cocoa and I thought, oh, I'll just, you know, try that out. And it came out great. But it's, you know, it's fun. Sometimes the limitations, you know, you talk about, you know, not being able to just call and order anything, but to work within limitations, it pushes your creativity to other limits that you otherwise wouldn't really explore.
I absolutely agree. I mean, and just hearing, and like, I loved your tamale recipe earlier, because that was something, like, I have so many corn husks in my larder right now at the restaurant, because whenever corn season was here, we were shucking a lot of corn and then shearing off the kernels and putting those in the freezer, and we were making stock out of the cobs, but I didn't really have a great idea of how to use the husk yet, so we dried a whole bunch of corn husk, and so now we just have...
Oh, perfect!
We have stacks and stacks of corn husk, so I think tamales will be on the menu here relatively soon.
Perfect. Well, I have a couple different... This is one recipe, and then I also have a tempeh tamale recipe, but I guess tempeh wouldn't be locally sourced in North Carolina.
We actually have made our own tempeh here before.
Have you?
Yeah, we started with a tempeh starter. Obviously, the tempeh starter wasn't from North Carolina, but we have made our own tempeh here at the restaurant.
Uh-huh. From soybeans that are grown in North Carolina?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Very
we have quite a few soy farmers here in North Carolina, actually. It's the difficult part is finding a soy farmer that doesn't have GMO, non-organic soy. That's the trick.
Of course, that was my next question. Perfect. I took it for granted that the products that you serve at your restaurant are GMO-free and organic when can be.
We do our best to source organic and non-GMO when possible. We try to work with heirloom varieties, mostly because of the flavor. The flavor in heirloom fruits and vegetables is just of such high quality. Organic is something that I go back and forth on. I think organic is very important. I try to support as many organic farms as I possibly can. But I'm also of the understanding that the organic label is something that farmers are paying for that label from the government. And it is based on their practices. But
Well, I'm talking about when I say organic, I don't really care so much about the label either. If you know the farmer, you know the practice.
Exactly.
That's what I'm talking about. The label is just, you know, more bureaucracy, and you really just need to know the practice. And, of course, if you're going for the flavor, chances are you're getting from people that are growing in a sustainable way. And same goes for your meat, I would assume. Like when you source a whole animal, you're getting an animal from a farmer that allows it to graze and eat grass and things like that, right?
Exactly. It's extremely important to us. Our chicken is all pasture-raised chicken here at the restaurant. Our beef is 100% grass-fed organic beef, which is extremely important. And, I mean, all the other ingredients that we work with, whether we're working with farm-raised fish, we're trying to make sure that the fish is fed an organic and non-GMO diet. And whenever we're working with wild-caught fish, that's less important. But it's important to try and work with as many good quality ingredients as you can. And that just so happens to a lot of times be non-GMO and organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned Dan Barber before. Did you ever see his TEDx talk on his relationship with a fish?
I did. I'm a huge Dan Barber fan.
Isn't that a great one? I mean, for those of you listening who don't know, I mean, you know, Dan, you should look it up. I'm on TEDx talk of Dan Barber's with his relationship with a fish. And it's, you know, the idea of a farm-raised fish. It's like, oh, great, let's raise a fish, you know, on a farm that you're not depleting the wild oceans and, you know, and you can control it. And, you know, you could think that it's going to be a good thing. And then he gets down to like, well, what's the fish eating? Fish pellets. And then like, well, what are fish pellets made out of? Food for fish. And then, you know, he had to push and research. And he finally finds out that fish pellets are being made from chicken scraps and chicken parts. And of course, GMO, non-organic chicken, but not even that. It's the parts that's getting thrown away. And the fish aren't supposed to eat chicken. So then you question what happens to the nutritional value and all that. It's a great, great piece. So I recommend everyone, you know, Googling it and finding it. It's fun. So what else would you like to share? We're almost out of time. What else would you like to share about your restaurant or what you're doing that I have not asked you yet?
I think you really covered a lot of it. I think the most important thing, I've talked about it a couple times, has been the wild mushroom legislation that we've been working on here in North Carolina. I'm a huge, huge fan of wild mushrooms, whether it be chanterelles or morels or black trumpets. There's so many different kinds. And we worked with over 20 different species now at the restaurant in the 2.5 years that we've been open. But for the large majority, and even still now, it's been illegal to harvest wild mushrooms in North Carolina and then serve them in the restaurant. Based on the food code that we operate under the 2009 food code. And so each state has its own food code that it operates under. In our food code, it doesn't allow us to harvest and use wild mushrooms. It actually makes it illegal. So we lobbied really hard on that. We worked with the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association. We worked with several other nonprofits to try and get this changed. And we spoke with legislatures. And we finally feel like that this January, whenever the North Carolina legislature comes back in session, that there will be some change and we will be able to serve wild mushrooms in restaurants. So
you're right. That's big and really exciting.
It's been one of the biggest accomplishments I've done. So.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I know, you know, dealing with any of those organizations, bureaucracies is challenging, even for something simple. So, you know, and I understand, you know, the same way the raw milk issue is a challenging one. I mean, it's, you know, some mushrooms can kill you. So someone really has to know what they're doing to forage for wild mushrooms and not pick the wrong one.
Exactly. And it's all about, from a public health perspective, it's about putting the systems in place that makes that the extremely least likely outcome that someone is going to forage a mushroom that's going to do harm to people. So putting the systems in place, making sure the foragers are knowledgeable, making sure the restaurants are knowledgeable, and making sure that we just make it as less likely that someone's going to forage a harmful mushroom.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you forage mushrooms and you go to a certain area, do you do anything special to be conscious to not deplete the area so that when you come back next year, you still have some? Like, only take a certain amount and be conscious to leave a certain amount? How does that work?
Well, see, so that's one of the misconceptions I think about foraging mushrooms is the best way to think about mushrooms. They grow on a system it's called mycelium, and it's sort of like a underground spider web, or the best way I heard it ever explained was my mentor called it an underground apple tree. So it doesn't hurt an apple tree, or it doesn't make an apple tree produce less apples for you to pick apples off the tree. Mm-hmm. The same way with mushrooms. They're just a fruiting body of the mycelium. So whenever you're harvesting a mushroom, you're not making it so that there will be less mushrooms to come back next year. What I try and do is harvest my mushrooms into a sort of those mesh netting bags, because I want the spores to drop off the mushrooms as I carry them out of the woods. And so in an ideal world, potentially those spores could come back and produce more mushrooms. So actually, by harvesting the mushrooms in that manner, you're leading to there being more mushrooms in the future, more than less mushrooms.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's great. Now, is there anything that you forage for that doesn't work like a mushroom, that you do have to be like ramps or fiddlehead ferns?
Exactly.
I wrote a
blog that's extremely informative about ramp foraging, and it's up on our website. It's heirloomrestaurantnc.com. But ramp foraging is one of those things. Ramps have become this hot, trendy item in recent years. And if we continue to forage ramps in the manner that we're doing it, then ramps will go the way of ginseng. It was once a really prolific crop all throughout the mountains of Appalachia, and now you can't find ginseng anywhere. I'm worried that ramps are headed in that same direction. Because when you're foraging ramps, it's extremely important to cut the bulb and leave the root system intact, and only forage a limited amount in an area. And most foragers are like practicing good harvesting practices, but there's always people who are out there strictly to make as much money as possible, and a lot of times that comes with harvesting as many ramps as possible and not worrying about the practices they're doing.
Well, no, and I'll get that link and I'll share it on my website too, so that people have it. Because you know, those are the kind of things that we all have to think about and share our knowledge, so that we, you know, protect our food supply, right? And support people foraging, doing things, but doing them in the right way.
Exactly.
Clark, thank you so much for joining me. It's been wonderful to have you. And everyone out there, thank you for joining me. It's been wonderful. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.
Thank you, Bhavani.